Hello, everyone. Welcome back to It's a Wonderful Podcast for another massively influential sci-fi movie discussion. Today, we opened our little series on sci-fi movies, our cross-show series, I must say, because Morgan hasn't seen he's being taken over by cyborgs and robots and science fiction itself all April long, as is this show, the main show where we celebrate the older movies in the world, in our lives, those special influential little things that came from decades ago, much like this movie today, and much like last week's movie as well, which really is the grandfather of the sci-fi epic Metropolis that we talked about last week. Wonderful movie that is, but today's movie is no less influential to a particular form of science fiction, perhaps a more recognisable form of science fiction, a more obviously sci-fi movie, I think, in its visuals, in its story, in its entire aesthetic, and what has really become the definitive sci-fi movie of the 1950s and is far grander and far more intelligent, I think, than what we may view 50s sci-fi as. We sometimes view 50s sci-fi as quite simplistic.
Or even B-movie level.
B-movie level, giant monsters, you know.
Campy insects.
Yeah, that sort of stuff. And that sort of stuff is great. We have some wonderful giant monster movies in the 50s, of course we do. But this is the next stage of sci-fi movies at this point. Forbidden Planet from 1956. I think it's reasonable to call it a sci-fi lover's sci-fi movie.
Yes.
A precursor to Star Trek. You could also call it. I think it's very clear. It's a precursor to a lot of the things we see in Star Trek, certainly the space exploration aspect, the big crew of people going to different planets, beaming down and that kind of stuff. You know, in a certain scene at the beginning of this movie, we get that. And the strange happenings going on these other worlds, perhaps one philosophical idea centered around this movie that I think is very, very well told. I think it's a very thoughtful movie. And like I said, it's a sci-fi lover's sci-fi movie. It treats that genre, I think, with so much love and respect that, yes, okay, some of the big monster movies and strange alien movies of the 50s certainly did do that came before this movie, but I don't think any did quite on this level. This is a sci-fi epic in itself, in scale, in size, in just enormous production value. It's equivalent of Metropolis. It looks phenomenal. It is a massive, massive movie. You could imagine seeing this on just the most enormous screen possible. And I think it is in CinemaScope or Panavision. It's massive to look at. And it really does kind of envelop you in this other world, which is something that sci-fi movies of its kind hadn't really done this well, or at least to this scale, before it.
Yes. Also not really taking themselves as seriously as this film wanted to. So definitely groundbreaking in that way and in several other ways, which I'm sure we will get into.
Oh, we certainly will. I mean, special effects-wise, I think this is
music,
So wonderful. Music-wise, even if you could call it music, because they don't even call it music in the credits of the movie, they're not quite sure what to call it. Well, they call it electrical tonalities, I think, which doesn't quite fall under the category of movie music because nobody had ever done a score
what they were
like
doing
before.
Yeah.
It's incredibly unique, incredibly creative. And yes, I'm very excited to talk about Forbidden Planet today. There is one thing we have to do before we get into today's discussion. That is say a big thank you to all our It's a Wonderful Podcast patrons, who we love dearly. If you would like to join them and join us on the Patreon or donate in any way, there are links in the description of this episode to go and do that and support us over there. Janine, would you like to start us off?
I would love to, with a huge thank you to Adam Witt.
And thank you to Michael Smith.
Thank you, Abby Friel.
Thank you, Faraz Muthana.
Thank you, 90s Comics Box, a.k.a. my big brother, Justin.
Thank you to Tina Farrow.
Thank you, Marcus Burton.
Thank you to Steve, Movie Fenobi.
Thank you, Samir Tesfai.
Thank you, Patrick Harden.
Thank you, Carla Fies.
Thank you to the great Ken Napsok.
Thank you to our good friends Tom and Kimber of Odd Shape Channel.
Thank you to Eric Garcia.
And thank you, Billy Paulahan.
Yes, applause for the patrons. Are we giving an applause to this movie, Janine? I think we are. If not only for its obvious influence and creativity.
Yes, I think we definitely are. I didn't think this film or know this film to be as groundbreaking as it was. I always just kind of, my mind just, you know, saw that imagery of the 50s style kind of tech and that iconic image, that poster image of a robot kind of holding a fainting, you know, sexy woman. So that imagery alone was enough for me to just file this in my mind as one of those kind of B-level, C-level 50s kind of campy sci-fi films. But to know that this was a film that really, you know, made by MGM, there was effort and thought, and this was, you know, going into this, telling audiences that this was going to be a groundbreaking, well thought out, kind of story focused sci-fi film. That was a surprise to me to learn that that's what this movie was meant to be. Because, you know, I always had this just kind of distant idea of it without really, you know, looking too much into it. So I'm glad I finally got to watch it and really see what went into it. I mean, we watched a documentary about this movie that compared the set design to last week's film or the film we talked in this series, Metropolis. So, and it, you know, I was thinking that while watching it, the scale of everything and just how vast it is. And I liked, you know, in the documentary, it was funny that they talked about, you know, not having quite the budget for such big sets, but the set designer was so fast in what he was creating that he was able to build almost a complete set by the time the money people came around and said, sorry, we don't have enough for this. They just had to make it work because the sets were almost done. So to know just how much went into really crafting an awe inspiring look for this film, I think was really interesting and creative. So
yeah, it's so obvious the amount of love I think that went in to Forbidden Planet, but it does keep those more almost typical elements of 50s sci-fi, doesn't it? You have a robot character in there, yet the robot character is so developed from earlier robot characters. I can't help thinking of, I forget his name now, but the robot from the day the earth stood still. The robot from the day the earth stood still, that is literally just a bland metal man. I mean, it looks fine. The day the earth stood still is a wonderful movie, but the visual of the robot and the visual in that and the visual of Robbie the robot from Forbidden Planet is night and day. In difference, in intricacy, in kind of thought put into Robbie that has all these moving parts to him. He's a fully fledged character. we love Robbie the Robot. Robbie the Robot was a fantastic success. He's one of the most recognizable sci-fi robots ever. Even if you don't know his name's Robbie, you know the visual of Robbie the Robot. Yeah. And he would go, he was the star of this movie. He would go on to have other movies where he was the lead of the movie.
Yeah, in this film, he got this introducing Robbie the Robot. So,
and he's great. He's so good.
Yeah.
We all want a Robbie the Robot. He's a helpful buddy in this movie. He's not evil.
Yes, even though the poster would have you think that he was kind of this evil.
You have to sell your movie. It's marketing.
Yes. Yes. Which is what I learned. So I was kind of going into it thinking the robot was going to be, it was going to be like this Dalek situation, a planet of these evil kind of robots that they would have to fight. So in kind of learning that it was kind of meant to take the story of the Tempest and also dabble into some Freudian concepts as well to craft the story was totally left field to discover. So
yeah, because Robbie definitely is not the villain of this movie. He is very much a helpful hand, and he does follow those kind of iRobot rules as well, which are always nice. You must not harm the humans. You must protect yourself unless it interferes with rule one of robots or whatever it is. The villain of this movie, well, is he really the villain? Because he's not quite aware he's the villain, is he?
The ultimate twist of this film then kind of brings it to a Twilight Zone or episodic, like a Star Trek episode you're meeting these new creatures and going to a new planet. And then you come upon this discovery. And by the end of the episode, our twist is revealed in this kind of unique way and unique twist. So it felt very episodic. In terms of where the story went.
I mean, the basic story to set us up is a crew of space explorers, headed, of course, by Leslie Nielsen in his younger years with delightful-looking brown hair.
Yes.
Very unusual.
Yes, definitely one of those actors. Definitely one of those actors where we never can picture them without their white hair. So to see him with brown hair was kind of fun. I mean, and yes, as you were saying, we did actually see him in Ransom! Exclamation point.
Ransom! Exclamation point.
But yes, that film was in black and white. So we saw that his hair was dark, but we didn't see the actual color. So if you want to know what Leslie Nielsen's real hair color looks like in color, watch Forbidden Planet.
Well, whether it's real color or not, it's Eastman color, I think. So it's the poppy bold color of this, isn't it? It is very brown, and he looks rather dashingly young, doesn't he?
And it's quite strange. Which is why he's perfect for the captain of this crew of space explorers sent on this mission, this rescue mission to save some people who were stranded on another planet. From the costuming to how he's, directing his crew very much feels like Star Trek probably took a big chunk of inspiration from this. I will say it did feel a little silly when he was they're all kind of on this in the same room on this bridge, and he gets his little microphone to make an announcement when it's like, you don't really need this microphone thing.
No,
you can literally just say what you need to say because everyone's like in close proximity to you. But the fact that it is this formal thing of him taking this device off the wall to amplify his voice when everyone's literally just like
yeah
within talking distance from him was just a little comical.
It is a little bit, because this is not, this spaceship is not the Enterprise that is this enormous thing. Yeah. This is a really rather small, I mean, it's big, it looks big as a set. You see the set of this flying saucer that's built, but it is a flying saucer. It's one room, really, isn't it? He doesn't need to be using this little communicator device to megaphone his voice up, but he does, and it's cool, and we like it. It fits with the tone of the entire movie. It's fine, but they all obviously land on the forbidden planet, on this planet. I forget the actual name of the planet. Is it like Altair 4 or something like that?
Something like that.
The name of the planet. And are completely taken aback by the scenery of this. I mean, it's this vast kind of barren, rocky landscape with this green sky and two moons.
Yes, and
it looks beautiful.
This like sand whoosh that kind of just travels by.
Yeah, that we learn is Robbie having you know, coming on his little little kind of coach thing
to take them back, and take them
to take them back to Walter Pidgeon, who has been in communication with them from the ship to, you know, in order to get permission to land and all that kind of stuff. Again, very Star Trek kind of concepts there.
Yes. And we already get the setup of kind of an ominous nature with this planet, because Walter Pidgeon, he's warning them. He's like, you know, sorry, you know, we don't need any help. Come at your own risk. And they're like, but we're on a mission to save any stranded people on this planet. And
Walter Pidgeon's you are one of them.
Yes. And he's like, nope, I'm good. Like, please, you don't need to come here. Please don't come. You know, it's dangerous here. Like, so he tries to warn them, but because, you know, they have their directive, they're going to follow it. So we're already getting this set up. There's something strange going on that, you know, is going to be lurking around this planet, that this man does not want them to be there. So I like that we get that initial already kind of going into this, like, okay, what's going on? Why is he giving him this warning? Why does he not want them around? So I like that we already set up how kind of we're going to see something kind of creepy going on around here.
I think there's a constant kind of morbid sense to the movie that while it's not a massively kind of action-packed movie, there's action scenes within the movie, but it's not full of action. There is a real constant underlying sense of dread of something just wrong. And it starts with that initial warning, but it carries on even when the movie seems perfectly genial. They've landed on the planet. They've gone to meet Walter Pidgeon. He's got this beautiful retro-futuristic home.
Yeah.
That his daughter's there, and his daughter, I mean, Anne Francis plays his daughter. This is also one of the most absurdly 50s depictions of a young kind of daughter
space girl
ever. It's way too on the nose.
Yeah. But
she's just, I don't know what human men are. I'm just here swimming in my little pool with nothing on.
Yes, they're literally
with
all
my tigers and my deers outside in the little garden I've made.
Yes.
And it's a little bit too fifties.
Yes, but I mean also then it's like she's the only girl and these men have been in space for however many days. So it's just several scenes of these men just kind of ogling her. One in particular, like the second in command guy, is like trying to hook up with her, but she has no concept of like kissing and what it's supposed to do for her and like what it's supposed to make her feel. So, you know, when one of them is really trying to like put some game on her, she's just like doesn't get it or really
Leslie Nielsen
anything. Yeah, or doesn't feel anything. And so then, you know, the captain, Leslie Nielsen, sees one of his men, like, trying to, like, you know, take her off into the woods and you know, make something happen. And he, you know, kind of scolds his man and then, like, has this frank conversation with her. Like, you can't just be going off with these dudes in the woods, you know, because they have a certain thing in their mind. And so he's trying to explain it to her. And she's very just kind of aloof about it because it doesn't make any sense to her.
Does kind and of then, come across like he's telling her off, though.
Yes, like very much like blaming her. Like, this is your fault for like wearing what you wear and like that whole thing. Like,
yeah.
So kind of
there's a little
great.
Bit too much of that in the in the movie.
But and then also the fact that that intrigues her about him. Like, is this very much? I'm mad at him, but I kind of like it. It's what the final. Feeling is for her from this situation. So then she ends up having Robbie help her make a more modest outfit to impress Leslie Nielsen, who gave her a lecture about her more scantily clad outfits that she'd been wearing.
Let's just say, I think what Anne Francis does in the movie is perfectly good. Nothing wrong with what she's doing.
Yeah.
The character is absolutely nothing in terms of depth. This is the unfortunate nature of this kind of character in this kind of
oblivious
movie, in this kind of way,
because she's meant to be oblivious, so she, you know, she doesn't have a ton to really, she doesn't have an arc really, she doesn't have a ton to do. It's more her kind of realizing maybe what's going on with her father and falling
in love
with this captain.
To that extent.
So I mean, but in terms of any kind of personality shift or change or like deep growth,
no, it's a realization more than anything else, isn't it?
yes so but you know what she has to do with the character in playing this woman who's never seen men or been around men before, I think she does a really good job with that kind of just this very aloof, like, oh, kissing, okay, sure. Like, so it's very believable as someone who has never, you know, really understood the concept of being attracted to somebody. So even when she has this conflict with the captain, and then that kind of grows into these feelings for him that she doesn't quite understand, like, that makes sense. Like, she's angry with him for kind of scolding her, but then she's intrigued that he's not really like trying to get with her like the other guys. And so she has kind of this mix of feelings that she's feeling for the first time. So I think all of that as a character who is feeling things newly, I think she does a good job with that.
She definitely does. I just don't think, unfortunately, that the movie excels in its romance aspect. But I don't think it really wants to, you know, it wants that to be front and center. It's just there because that's what these movies are like at this
time.
Well,
yes. And they, since they are kind of roughly following the Tempest story, that is the plot point. That, you know, this man and his daughter isolated on this island, and a man, you know, a crew comes to the island, and the daughter falls in love with a member of the crew and goes off with him. So it's just very much to fit the plot point of their kind of core story of following the Tempest. So
I think what or where this movie does excel in the best way, though, is with the whole sequence where the crew of the ship have kind of become a little bit concerned that Walter Pidgeon isn't quite telling them all he needs to tell them.
Yeah.
And Walter Pidgeon plays this really well. He has this very gentlemanly persona, but very wise, very solitary kind of attitude that he brings to this movie. It's really very, it's kind of aloof in its own way. Not in the same sense as his daughter, but it is this almost holier-than-thou kind of attitude that he kind of does have. He's happy to be here studying this planet on his own and not telling anybody else about it because he likes having the knowledge for himself. Yet he's not an outwardly evil character at all.
But it's really obvious he's hiding something.
It's a little bit obvious he's hiding something, but he's really quite friendly. He's genial. Yeah. He's welcoming. He offers them food and all this kind of thing. Food that, by the way, is synthetically made by Robbie because he can just memorize ingredients and then just produce them from within himself. He's very convenient. Robbie the robot.
Oh yes, especially for the chef from the crew who shares with him a bottle of booze, and then Robbie proceeds to produce stacks and stacks of bottles of this booze.
Not like 60 gallons of whiskey or something like that that this alcoholic chef has to drink.
Yes.
This chef, it's by the way, exciting. Is clearly just an alcoholic. I'm concerned about this man.
Yes. He's got a problem.
He's got a problem. He needs to get his problem sorted. I think everybody else in the crew knows he's got a problem. And Leslie Nielsen just kind of looks at him with a bit of a side eye and goes, come on, man, okay, sort your problem.
Chill out. Yeah, yes. But
he's a little bit of a comical character, I think.
Yeah, he brings little comic relief moments, him and interacting with Robbie, and they're kind of little back and forth trying to figure each other out.
They become really quite good
buds, don't they? Yeah.
What were we talking about now before we were talking
about the show? Our villain and how suspicious he is, but he's also very kind of welcoming. So they have issues kind of trying to read him, but they decide to like try to look into him to see really what's going on, because they feel like maybe he's not telling them everything they need to know about the other people, what happened to them, why are him and his daughter the only ones there. So, they're looking for answers.
By looking to him and looking for answers, we of course mean break into his house.
Yes. Essentially, yes. And snoop around.
And snoop around, which he doesn't take kindly to, Walter Pidgeon. And by the way, I think Walter Pidgeon is wonderful in this movie. He's so good. He is the real... He is what brings this movie a certain legitimacy that I think it needed at the time, because he's a big name actor. He had been in the Best Picture winning Mrs. Miniver that we of course covered I think back in September now on this show. He's Mr. Miniver in that movie, and he's wonderful in that movie. And in quite a strange way, I don't think I noticed this in Mrs. Miniver. I don't remember noticing this in Mrs. Miniver. There is a certain George Sanders quality to Walter Pidgeon in this movie, I think.
I mean, now that you say that, and I literally just watched a George Sanders movie, so he's fresh in my mind. But yes, I could see how you'd get there.
Maybe not quite as witty, but in gait, in kind of the way he carries himself.
Yeah.
And
sauntering around.
Sauntering around. Perhaps it's also the sense of being a little bit full of himself, which Walter Pidgeon is in this movie.
Yeah.
Yet not quite as obnoxiously as George Sanders often is when he's full of himself in his movies. Wonderfully obnoxious, by the way. We love George Sanders.
Yes. But
I kind of felt that. But there's a, he brings class to the movie, and it just helps. It helps this movie, I think, become what it has become, because I don't think it was an enormous success on initial release. Yet it has obviously in the decades since been continued to be realized as influential as it was.
Yeah.
I think people at the time were looking for sci-fi movies to be those giant monster movies and a little bit, those more B movies. And there's nothing wrong with a good B movie, of course there's not. But to have a glossy MGM movie be a sci-fi movie, it's something that hadn't happened before Forbidden Planet.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a new, interesting, but kind of tentative thing, perhaps, for audience at, audiences at the time. And Walter Pidgeon, I think, is such a key part of making this movie become what it has become, because really he is kind of the lead of the movie. He's not the protagonist, but he's the lead, really, isn't he? He's the central character.
He's the one that holds the key to everything.
Leslie Nielsen isn't good enough as a straight actor to really hold this movie together. He's fine. He's perfectly good. There's a reason Leslie Nielsen became a deadpan comedic actor.
Yeah.
Because he had a decent enough career as a straight actor, as a straight man, but he excelled when he just turned the comedic switch a little bit later in life, as we well know. But Walter Pidgeon is the central force.
Yeah, I mean, he's the key to all the mysteries that we're trying to uncover. So he's the center of everything, you know, everything revolves around him. So I like that they kind of centralize him in that way, so that everything happening around him helps drive that story, because it's kind of a mystery that we're trying to solve. So he holds all the answers, even if he doesn't know that he holds all the answers. So and it makes him a really interesting character.
Please talk about what I think is the best sequence of the movie, and it's the journey into the mystery, almost the journey into the underground world, where this ancient civilization that lived on this planet, the Krell, they were able to create this incredibly advanced technology. This entire sequence of discovery is phenomenal.
Oh, yes. This whole underground space that they end up going to, that Walter Pidgeon's showing them, just kind of the vast scale of it and, you know, just how deep it goes. And these really interesting shaped doors that slide open. And then, you know, he shows them this device that kind of reads your brain waves and like can kind of manifest whatever you think of. And so just the special effects in creating those things, and the laser beams that they're shooting down there, and the images that they're projecting, like all of that is so well done for the 50s. Like, you would not expect to, because like you see effects done like that in like the 80s. I know we had kind of talked about Ghostbusters when we did our ghost series on Morgan Hasn't Seen, and we had watched we had preemptively watched the original 80s Ghostbusters before talking about Afterlife on the show, and like I could equate some of these effects very close to what we saw in 1984 in Ghostbusters. So fact that they were able to...
I think that there are effects in Forbidden Planet, 1956's Forbidden Planet, that look more legitimate than some effects in some movies now.
Yes. I mean, I think the greatest bit is the bit when we actually do kind of get to see what is kind of stalking around the planet, because
there is an actual monster in the movie. Let's not go past that. There is,
you know, they start to get very suspicious of Walter Pidgeon and what he knows and what really happened to the rest of the people on the planet. Men start getting attacked, and we hear these strange noises. Like, we have two men guarding the outside of the ship, and one of them's kind of like, "Do you hear that? Some strange like breathing." And we hear these really interesting sounds. It sounds like kind of an irregular heart beating, and these weird kind of, musical kind of breathing sounds. And it's this invisible thing walking. We see these really interesting, like, large footprints that almost like have a one big hook toe. And we just see the footprints and how they're able to do this effect of this invisible thing, just showing the footprints being created. We see the steps of the ship bend under the weight of this invisible thing we don't see. And then a couple men get attacked and killed. So now, you know, the mystery has escalated because now people are dying. So we need to know what's going on. And, you know, from there, Walter Pidgeon only gets more suspicious and more secretive. And now it becomes like this ticking time clock to figure out what is really going on. What is this creature that we're facing so more men don't get killed? So there are kind of several nights where people on guard think they've seen something, but they can't see it. And so they set up this trap to try to catch the monster. And then we get this really great kind of outline animation of the monster being like trapped by their laser beams. And it's done through animation.
It's incredible to look at. They got somebody from Disney to do the animation from it. Because that's how they wanted the effects to be. But every bit of visual special effect that you see in this movie is animation. Like there's times when Robbie will short circuit and it's done in this kind of poppy little animation. It almost weirdly reminds me, and I suppose this makes sense given that it's Disney, it reminds me of the magic in Bedknobs and Broomsticks.
Yeah.
When it would kind of sparkle and pop around and
weirdly
kind of shimmer.
Yeah.
Twinkle. There's that kind of thing when Robbie short circuits. And it just works. It just looks genuine to me. Even though it's animation, it's clearly animation. It just feels more genuine to me.
Yeah.
That is what's happening at this point than so much effects work that comes decades and decades after this movie. There's something really pleasant about looking at these effects in this movie. And knowing that little documentary that we did watch on it, they'd spoken about perhaps doing the physical form of the monster. And we'll get into exactly what this monster is as well, of course. But the physical form of the monster, they spoke about perhaps doing it in stop motion, like a Harryhausen movie.
Yeah, like a Harryhausen kind of claymation type figure. But they didn't
which
want
we
it
love
to be
as well.
Yes, which I mean would have been really fun, like a Jason and the Argonauts kind of vibe. But they decided they didn't want it to be a fully formed thing, like a kind of tangible thing.
Yeah,
they liked the idea of it being kind of the essence, the outline, and it made it scarier because they felt like the audience could, you know, the buildup of it, the audience could create their own monster and whatever you could create in your own mind is scarier than anything that they could make. And so if they just give you kind of these glimmers of an outline of this creature, you know, that's scary enough for your mind to kind of fill in the blanks, which I think is really a really smart way to go about it.
It is, and doubly so when you actually think about what the monster specifically is. The fact it's not one whole tangible thing. The fact it is just this shimmering, animated, glaring red with these massive yellow eyes outline.
And this mouth kind of growling and teeth. And like, so you get this outline of these kind of scary elements. And then you kind of fill in those gaps.
The fact it's not whole, though, this is what I'm saying, with what the monster actually is there to represent.
Yeah.
It makes so much more sense that it isn't something you can touch. It makes so much more sense that it isn't something you can see, because that monster is manifested from something that you can't touch.
And from this concept. It's come from a deeper concept, which is where kind of the Freudian concepts come in, which is what makes this feel like a kind of Twilight Zone Star Trek episode for me. As you know, you think it's something far more tangible, but it ends up being something really concept driven and kind of mentally driven.
And the fact we keep bringing up Star Trek and Twilight Zone is so interesting, because we almost view them as peers, yet it isn't. this movie's a decade before both of those things.
Exactly.
This is what gave those the ideas for this kind of thing. This is what gave those seminal television programs the, I suppose, the risk-taking ability to be able to present these kind of ideas within a science fiction concept, within this, the philosophical sci-fi, as we can call it, thoughtful sci-fi, idea sci-fi,
yeah,
that is so heavily present in Forbidden Planet, while still being space exploration sci-fi, still being kind of fun robot sci-fi. There's both. It's not one or the other. Like, we found Metropolis last week, the sci-fi elements of Metropolis.
Yeah.
It's very thoughtful, it's very philosophical, and it's very serious, really, isn't it? There's it's an entertaining movie. There's little fun about Metropolis, but it's an entertaining movie. There's plenty of fun in Forbidden Planet. There's things, you know, for the entire family. It's a family movie, really. Forbidden Planet. It's can be open to for anybody to watch. Yet the fact it has this really serious, really intelligent idea behind it, based around Walter Pidgeon and his obsession with learning about this ancient Krell civilization from this planet. And he just kind of builds it up within himself and, well, bites off more than he can chew, really.
Yes, and in this effort to expanding, in this effort to expand his mind, he's almost broken it in a way, in this effort to absorb as much knowledge as possible. He's kind of splits his mind into two parts without realizing it, and that's kind of what causes our big problem.
Yeah, this big problem, the monster itself, the invisible monster, spurts out from this broken part of Walter Pidgeon's mind.
Yes.
It is a manifestation of primal terror.
Yes, which is the Freudian concept of the id, which is kind of a primal side of you that is kind of uncontrollable. So this split happens without him realizing it, and the monster that is terrorizing the planet is his crazy uncontrollable id just running rampant.
It's his obsessive side. His overworked brain has broken itself and created this monster he can't control, he doesn't even realize is a part of him, and it is fairly unstoppable. We see it be very, very deadly and effective. And all the weaponry, all the little blasters that they all have, all the crew shooting these purple lasers out, it's great. And this big trap that they put on that we talk about, of these almost laser gates that they have going around the perimeter of the ship to catch the monster within these gates and pepper it, shoot it, you know, try and get rid of it. It doesn't really ever go away.
Yeah.
The monster keeps going. The monster is fairly unstoppable, and we see it be deadly. We see it be deadly multiple times.
Yeah.
And the fact it all comes from his mind, without him realizing it, leads to what is really quite a bittersweet, well, I say bittersweet, it's more heartbreaking, it's more devastating of a finale, really, because Walter Pidgeon's whole world comes crashing down on him. He has spent decades at this point on this planet, becoming so deeply ingrained in the history of this race, in the history of this civilization, trying to expand his knowledge more and more and more. And this entire movie is just a lesson on don't bite off more than you can chew. Like, knowledge is fantastic, but you can't keep all that knowledge to yourself.
Yeah.
Share the knowledge, share the load. You know,
yes,
that's what the movie tells you to do. Otherwise, you'll just chaos for yourself.
Yes, you'll overwhelm yourself. And even when, you know, Leslie Nielsen has discovered this and is trying to tell him and explain it to him, he refuses to believe it. You know, Leslie Nielsen and the daughter, she's like, I'm going to leave with them because you can't accept what you are and what you've done. You know, we're telling you this is what's happening. And all the knowledge he has is still not enough for him to be able to rationalize what's happening to him and what he's done. Ultimately, yeah, I mean, kind of this hunger and greed for knowledge comes at the detriment of lost lives and kind of this man's descent into kind of this failure state.
Yeah, it is heartbreaking, but it's such a moral lesson, and it's the kind of sci-fi that again Star Trek would do every week so well.
All the time.
You know, it would always have these kind of concepts. You'd go, you know, the crew would go to a planet, they'd find some issue there, and it would all be, you know, an issue that they didn't quite realize they had, but they managed to get rid of, even if it meant heartbreak and destruction.
Yeah,
dealt with it, and that's what we get at the end of this movie, really. And because the monster starts to come after Walter Pigeon himself.
Yeah,
Walter Pigeon comes after himself in a weird way. it's an interesting idea. It's a greatly executed idea.
Yeah,
because you see the terror, you see the tension, you see the chaos he causes. His own monster destroys his house, breaks into the underground world through all these enormous scaled vent shafts and enormous machines that we can't state just how enormous these kind of machines are. I mean, we think Star Wars and the Death Star did kind of walking through enormous machinery really, really well. This is 20 years before Star Wars, and it does it just the same.
Great, yeah.
It looks the exact same. I know people always go on about how phenomenally influential Star Wars was in the development of movie special effects, and it of course was, but there's little about Forbidden Planet that's noticeably worse.
Yeah, I mean, everything I think looks, for the time, it looks great at the scale of it, the effort that went into it. It's all very impressive. I think that's why you can make those comparisons to something like Metropolis, this groundbreaking, large scale, and, you know, even kind of doing forced perspective to make things look bigger and feel like they're really moving.
Miniatures.
Yes. So a lot of great effects here. For such an early film that definitely feel like it laid the groundwork for so many familiar great things that would come after this. So just incredibly impressive on its own.
Yeah, I suppose you can talk about 2001 as well. 2001 A Space, which I think, to be honest, probably the actual space visualization in 2001 is better than the space visualization in Forbidden Planet. But that's, you know, 12 years apart. So you might be, you know, you might want some development by that point.
Yeah.
The actual flying saucer traveling through space, mainly at the beginning of Forbidden Planet, looks so good. It looks great. It looks incredible. And you can only imagine how awestruck people must have been watching this real, true space travel in the mid-50s on an enormous screen in glorious MGM production value, Panavision, Eastman color, everything. It's stunning to look at. It really, really is, especially, you know, like we say, when the vast majority of sci-fi was set on Earth and the spaceships that were there wouldn't be shown to this patient extent. I think there's a lot of patience in Forbidden
Planet
as well. Like I said before, it's not a hugely action-packed movie. It wants to sit you in this world. It wants to allow itself to wash over you.
Yeah, and it's not afraid to let you kind of look around and live in it. And, you know, it's not trying to hide any kind of production flaws or things that they maybe didn't know how to do yet, or, you know, hide things. It really wanted you to walk around and look at everything and just kind of be enveloped in this world that they created.
Yeah. And why not? Why wouldn't you want to be? I want to be watching this movie. You know, it's really, really great. It's a total visual treat, as well as being a really interesting story.
Yeah.
And a really interesting concept that, as we say, ends in quite heartbreaking fashion when Walter Pigeon's own monster crashes into the laboratory room that is his home. It's his home, really. It's where he wants to be more than anything else. You have all these dials and kind of radar thing. They're not radar, but I don't know. Science devices going crazy.
Yeah.
We'll have to get some sort of scientist on to tell us exactly
what these things are. Yeah.
But they're all going, you know, they're all going crazy. There's lights everywhere, there's smoke everywhere, and it's because his monster has finally come to greet him in this ball of fire and flame.
Yeah, it's very almost intense.
At this point. It's like it's hellish at this point, isn't it? And it ends in Walter Pigeon's demise. Well, it doesn't just end in Walter Pigeon's demise, it ends in the Death Star against Alderaan level of destruction of the entire planet.
Really. Yes, and the crew and his daughter ultimately end up, you know, getting away and flying off from their spaceship.
Walter Pigeon's own brain monster destroys all this advanced nuclear, I suppose, technology of the Krell civilization that's buried deep under the surface of the planet and blows the entire planet up. Yeah. So Walter Pigeon, in all his, you know, dedication, in his life's work to learning about the Krell, just does too much.
Yeah.
Does too much and ends up destroying everything that mattered to him. Mm-hmm. Don't do too much, people.
Yes,
and he's telling you to do.
Yes, and I love that, you know, your villain always has, you know, I think it's a trope for them to have some sense of greed in terms of, you know, money or power. But the fact that, you know, his greed is for knowledge is kind of an interesting, very sci-fi concept in and of itself. So I like that.
Very much so. Very, very, very much so. I mean, there's a certain... I suppose there's a certain 50s horror to it as well, because obviously all the time at the 50s, it's all nuclear war and, you know, God, what's going to happen? We're all terrified of potential nuclear war and technological advancement and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, we see firsthand, I think, at the end of this movie, that all this technological advancement and just how destructive that can be if in the wrong hands.
Yeah.
Because ultimately it was in the wrong hands with Walter Pigeon.
Yes, yeah. Definitely so, playing into, you know, kind of topical happenings of that time for sure.
Which sci-fi and horror always should do. Mm-hmm. Always should do. And certainly very much did in the 50s, but this takes a more nuanced, more thoughtful approach to it than perhaps just some alien invasion that is some faint allegory of communism or something like that that you would get in the 50s. Oh, look at all these aliens doing the exact same thing all the time. How efficient these aliens are. But they're very destructive, aren't they? Yes, they're very destructive. They're taking away my American individualism. And that is every other 50s sci-fi movie, but not Forbidden Planet. Forbidden Planet is cleverer.
Yes, I would agree.
Smarter than that.
Yes.
And what a great movie.
Yes, I had a lot of fun with this movie. I really thought it was going to be a little bit silly and really play into that B-movie aesthetic that I kind of always thought of 50s sci-fi, because, like, you know, what do they know about sci-fi? and giant robots and, you know, silly monsters. But I love that everyone kind of was told to, like, play this seriously. Like, we are making a real picture here. We are making an A-list sci-fi film for once.
Yeah.
And you feel that. And it went into the production. We didn't even talk about the music. I mean, we talked about
Let's talk about the music.
Yes. These just interesting tones that would take these two, I'm calling them composers, hours to put together. They would have to build pieces to make the sounds they use in the film. And ultimately, I think they were just meant to do kind of these interesting, you know, techie kind of sound effects. And then, you know, the studio really liked the sounds of those things that they asked them to score the whole film. So these sounds that we're hearing, these weird, ominous electronic sounds, end up also kind of doing double duty as music almost for the film,
yeah,
as well, which is just so interesting.
You'd be forgiven for thinking there's so much cliche in Forbidden Planet and its music and things like that. But there's a reason things become cliche is because they're so great to begin with. Everybody else does them.
Yeah.
And everybody else ended up doing this kind of thing, so it becomes that cliche. The electrical music and sound effects in Forbidden Planet are phenomenal.
Yes, it's, and they say they were groundbreaking. Like, that these sounds and the things that they were doing and created were kind of the earliest examples of electronic music as we kind of know it today. So incredibly trailblazing what they were able to do with these sounds.
The synthesizer score. 25 years before the synthesizer and that kind of stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's mad to think of it. And the movie wouldn't work had it had those be sound effects and an orchestral score.
Yeah.
I don't think because the orchestral score brings, I mean, we say this, Star Wars has the orchestral score of all movies ever, doesn't it, really? But, and is phenomenal for it, but I don't necessarily think Forbidden Planet works.
No, with all of that, it didn't need that. It needed these ominous sounds that not only kind of play into what this invisible creature sounds like, but also just kind of building the tone and vibe of where we are in the world, which is what a score does. So the fact that these crazy sounds doubled as a score was able to kind of fluidly do both is such a clever thing for a movie like this. So yeah, I really, really enjoyed that addition to the film for sure.
Yeah, and as we said before, it helps even more so to envelop you watching it into the entire movie, because you're hearing all these sounds come from every which way.
Yeah.
And you can sit in the world at that point. You're not hearing outside score. You're not hearing outside big brass instruments and string instruments and all these kind of
things. You're set still in the world,
And there's every reason to believe that these sounds are coming from within the world itself.
Yeah.
Which is the most important thing about the music in this movie, is everything seems like it would be coming from that particular landscape.
Yeah.
It's great. It's so, so good. Forbidden Planet. Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful sci-fi movie. Deeply, deeply influential. And a great talk today on this episode of It's a Wonderful Podcast. Janine, I love celebrating these kind of movies, the ones where you can physically and visibly see what came after it has this movie to thank for.
Yeah.
Like everything, every sci-fi movie, every sci-fi thing that
must have taken something from this film for sure. Must have.
It's incredible. Yeah. The originality of Forbidden Planet in 1956 is second to none.
Yes.
And
Very impressive.
Very, very thankful we have covered it on this show. We, of course, move in to some 70s sci-fi next week on the show. I think it's Westworld.
Yeah.
Which would be very, very interesting in itself, sticking with our kind of robot theme as well. We had Robbie in this. We had, you know, I can't even remember what the robot for Metropolis is called.
Well, she turned into Maria, but yes.
Robot Maria.
Yes.
Yes. Last week in Metropolis. Great. Sci-fi on the main show. It's such a rarity, and I enjoy it when it comes around. Yeah,
because, I mean, people don't think of classic sci-fi, really. So it's definitely...
Unless the sci-fi lovers.
Yes, I mean, so it's a very untapped era for sci-fi in people's minds immediately, I think.
Yeah, I think too many people dismiss the 50s sci-fi as what we've dismissed the 50s sci-fi.
Yes, like we literally went into this with kind of this preconceived thought of what 50s sci-fi looked like, and this film happily kind of proved us wrong. So,
oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. Wonderful. Well, yay. There we go, I think, for this episode of It's a Wonderful Podcast, Ginny. And of course, sci-fi is over on Morgan Hasn't Seen as well, as we mentioned before, all April long with cyborgs and robots and all the fun stuff we have over there. It was RoboCop this week. That's very exciting, isn't it? Much different sci-fi movie to Forbidden Planet. You can't compare Forbidden Planet to RoboCop. It's incomparable entirely. Yeah. But he's another great, great movie. Go and check that out. Every Wednesday, Morgan Hasn't Seen. Every Friday with It's a Wonderful Podcast, the main show. Subscribe to this podcast feed wherever you are listening, on all major podcast platforms. Of course, we also have the It's a Wonderful Podcast YouTube channel for you to go and subscribe. Ding your notification bells over on. There is a video episode of that RoboCop discussion as well from Morgan Hasn't Seen this week up on that YouTube channel as well. So go and check that out. Leave all your likes and all that fun stuff over there. We spoke about the Patreon and the donation links before. Of course, they are down in the description. But you can also find us on social media, on Twitter at It's a Wonderful One. Find me on Twitter at The Purple Don with a 3 instead of the E in the because, Janine.
3 is a magic number.
On Instagram, TikTok, and Threads at The Purple Don. All your forbidden stuff.
You can find me at JanineDeVine_ on Twitter, JanineDeVine on Instagram, TikTok, and Threads. If you want to get any merch for any of our shows, just check the description for the link or search It's a Wonderful Podcast on teespring.com. And if you want to purchase any of my art in print form, you can find that at my Big Cartel shop, g9design.bigcartel.com.
How accurately do you think you can give me an impression of Robbie the robot, Ginny?
Oh my god, it'll probably just be generic robot, so.
I mean, Robbie the robot doesn't not sound like a generic robot.
Right? So, 3, 2, 1.
I think that's very, very accurate. Bye!
Bye!